17th, year 2001. This is the second part of an oral history interview with Dr. Sam Robinson. The interview takes place in Dr. Robinson's new office at the Urban Montessori School in Louisville, Kentucky. And the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Sam, give me a voice level just so I know. Well, Sam, yesterday I attended the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights ceremony, their tribute to Martin Luther King, and I was interested in Governor Breathitt's comments, but also your introduction to him. And I wanted to go back and ask you, when the two of you were both involved in the three-year Lincoln School Project, was Governor Breathitt the governor at the time?
Yes, he was.
He was,
yes.
Okay. And was he ever actually involved in any of the hands-on of school?
Definitely. He was involved in identifying individuals to be involved in the planning and developing a mission statement for the school. And yes, he was very hands-on with the committee, which included Dr. H. Rep. Jackson, who was a minister in Frankfort, Kentucky, and Dr. William Young Sr., and Mr. Don Bell, who at the time was a associate superintendent at the State Department of Education. And those were some of the people involved at that time.
Okay. And did he help to hire you, to bring you on board?
Yes, he was part of the process. But mainly that was part of a University of Kentucky problem or issue that they were involved in. Well, I have to tell you this, that when Lincoln School closed, Dr. Young was very concerned about my welfare. Even after the school closed, when the school had not closed, there was a group working on the future of that site. And so what I did for 1 year, I was involved in the planning and execution, and really I was kind of the caretaker for the Lincoln Foundation property. And I did not, and so I was employed to be very honest with you, I received my check from the University of Kentucky.
And we talked about the school last time, and the dissertation you gave me was very helpful to understanding that more. One of the things I wanted to ask you though, Sam, is how do you get to the campus of the Lincoln?
Well, the Lincoln, as you know, it's the Whitney Young Job Corps Center.
Okay.
And it's 30 miles east of Louisville on US 60. And if you are traveling from Louisville to Frankfort, you can't miss the building. The first building built there was Berea Hall, named after Berea College. And there is a center part, and then there's one from the center. There is one extension of one. What do you call it? The original intent was to have the center, and then have on one side classroom, the education, and on the other side a chapel for the students who enrolled, but that never happened. So the building was never fully completed as planned.
I've been talking with the film crew over this documentary that we're doing about maybe actually going out and you want to interview you at some point for the film, but doing it on the side of the campus.
Yes, because it's very historic. You have Belknap Hall, which is named for one of the industrialists of the early days. You have Eckstein Norton Hall. All of these halls are mainly for affluent business people in and around the state, really mainly from the Louisville area. You also have the Whitney M. Young Hall. You have the Carroll Hall, which was named for Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Carroll, who spent together maybe 50 years as a couple living on their campus, and one was the principal of the school, or they call it dean of education, and her husband taught school, and he was the vice president to Dr. Young. But it's very interesting about titles at Lincoln Institute, because Mr. Carroll had the title of vice president, but he was he taught classes. He had at least maybe one period less than the other teachers to tend to vice president duties. And but many times he didn't have much to do because Dr. Young was pretty much in charge of what happened and so forth. So he made the major decisions.
Okay. What I want to do for most of our time together today is talk about you and the Lincoln Institute.
Okay.
You've just stepped down after...
You mean the Lincoln Foundation.
Lincoln Foundation, I'm sorry. You've just stepped down after 26 years.
That's right.
And I've never met anybody who's had so many celebrations and retirement parties given for them and so many photos in the paper. But I'm interested to know, tell me, how did you actually move to join the staff of the foundation?
Well, it was very interesting. I was in the Army, and I had planned to try and look for employment and did not want to return to Memphis because I had too many brothers and sisters who lived there.
Let me stop you, because maybe I know you and I, when we talked before, we talked about you going to the Lincoln School and your work there.
No, the Lincoln Institute.
The Lincoln Institute.
Institute, because the Lincoln Institute and the Lincoln School are two different
separate. So the Lincoln Institute, then the Lincoln School is the government-funded program with Governor Breathitt.
Yeah, through the legislature.
Right. And then that closed.
Right.
And then...
I went to Shawnee High School as principal, and then after 3 years, I left there to complete a doctorate at Indiana University. And then I came back. And what I did was took a leave of absence because I just to be sure that the things did go right. But one of the most interesting aspects of that is that I was to be the first African American to be the president. I mean, the executive director, and later we changed the title to president. But I was very much aware that there was some reluctance on the board's part to employ an African-American in that position. And I thought it was because of the aggressive nature of Dr. Whitney M. Young Sr. He handpicked me for that role because he advised me that to go on and get your doctorate. Go on, and I want to have it so that there will not be any questions related to your qualifications. However, it was most interesting that the person I a person that I took his place, you know, the person that was in charge before I came there, did not have a bachelor's degree.
Now, was that the white fellow?
Yes, Mr. J. Mansatidis.
Yes.
And so, and I picked up that he was very involved in the human resources, the organization that Representative Clyburn talked about, Human Rights Workers, the National Association of Human Rights Workers, and I always felt that he would have liked, and going back to some of the minutes, I think that he would have, he knew people in that, and I think that that would have been possibly his choice, for someone who had a human rights, human relations background, because that was his background. Because he stood as the editor of the official journal of that group for many times, and he was he was not paid. That was just something he did as part of his work as executive director of the Lincoln Foundation.
Did he retire from the foundation?
Well, he was most interested in what happened. I was employed, well, when I left, I worked, before I went to IU, I worked 1 month at the foundation because I needed the money, you know, because I was going to not be employed. My wife stayed here, and I came home on the weekends. But Mr. Toddins was not involved in fundraising. He basically served, I think his role was, he was a community resource. And that was part of his job, is to serve. He went to a lot of meetings dealing with human relations, the desegregation, so forth. He went to a lot of meetings. And he was not involved in fundraising. But when I was asked to take the job, I was told that I would have to be very aggressive in identifying funds to pay my salary. Because the first year was to be one where both of us were to be there. That they were going to, he was going to mentor me through the process, because I had not worked for a foundation, was not, you know, I was new about the foundation from a distance, because Mr. Toddins did not make frequent trips to the Lincoln Institute, because, and so we would see him when the board meeting was being held, and once in a while I would run into him coming to have conversations with Dr. Young.
And you told me before that they had moved his office downtown. Off the campus,
yes.
Earlier.
And I also reminded you that Mr. Toddins did not work for Dr. Young. Mm-hmm. He worked for the board of the foundation because his father-in-law was T.C. Gaines. And that was the understanding. And that was a constant source of friction that both of them talked about the relationship, you know. And so there was a certain amount of mistrust and distrust because of the relationship.
So they hired you, and you were to work with him for
1 year. And it was very explicit in terms of what I was supposed to be doing. I was supposed to mainly earn my keep, while they paid him with the money that, because we were talking about small sum of money. We talked about less than $100,000, because the Lincoln Foundation gave out a few scholarship loans, and usually the projects that, well, to be very honest with you, Mr. Tyler had a free reign. in terms of what he did, because the board didn't meet but twice a year. And it was just maybe to rubber stamp his project, which one of them was Youth Speaks, which was an excellent program which brought about early communication between African American and white students, and with a TV program, and they would talk about issues related to desegregation, inequities in our society, and how can we bring about more interracial cooperation. Also, Mr. Tidings was very involved in a movement called Moral Rearmament, which goes back to that time. That was basically, again, interracial type of individuals who would go to this place in Mackinac Island for their meetings and so forth. And it was very interesting because Mr. Tidings was well respected, and he was really one of the forerunners in terms of interracial cooperation. Because as you know, he was fired from the Jefferson County Human Relations Commission because of some of his stance. And so he was there, but he was also paternalistic. Now, that's my assessment.
Okay. So at the end of the year, he departed.
No.
No?
No. What happened was that I came to the job in August, after I had completed my work at IU, around mid-August.
Is this 1974? Okay.
And Mr. Tidings became ill maybe a month after I took the job. And he never recovered. He died. So
Okay.
And we had that. Mr. Tidings and I had some minor problems at the beginning because I thought that he, as I said, he was paternalistic. And one issue that really concerned me had to do with the budget, the preparation of the budget and so forth, and he did that alone and indicated to me that he thought that that I could not do that. Although I had been the principal of a school and of a school with 1,800 kids, and budgets had to be prepared, and I let him know that I was displeased with that because I thought he was putting me at a disadvantage because I should have been involved in the budget planning. And I was very displeased about that.
Especially if they were looking to you to help raise the money.
And that's right.
How did you go about doing that in the early years?
Well, we always have had people involved in supporting the organization, but they had never been asked to give funds for support. And since the beginning, since we began that fundraising effort, we have had an anonymous giver who has been extremely supportive of the foundation. In fact, the last donation that we received from this anonymous person for this year, one person, was $175,000 because he was given, she was given the funds for the transition that just recently taken place. Since we were, Dr. King, Charles King, has been with the foundation since August and payroll, and then, we had two big two salaries. And he had all of his benefits and all of that, but he didn't really assume the role until December 1st when I took him out to vacation, and he was in charge during that time. So this person, and we, to be very honest with you, I have never had a real issue about raising money. I don't know. It's, you know, I think it has a lot to do with a person feeling that you you will be a good, what is the word I want to use? Good, good, that you will use the money wisely. That it will not be any hanky-panky, and that you will. And in fact, I have always, in fact, right now, that when I began to move out of the office, I took a lot of stuff because, like for instance, a lot of the artwork I bought myself, because I didn't want the foundation to ever think that I was trying to be extravagant at their expense. And so I would buy things. And so it just started to, and in 26 years, I have always had a balanced budget and never had a year in the red, because I was frugal and I tried to use the money for programs more than anything else.
Has fundraising, though, over the years, Sam, been a big part of your job?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has been. And program development. And my strategy is to see where the resources are and then try to develop programs with that in mind. A good example, the Minority AIDS program. We have a $300,000 budget for that. When I started out, we started out with $10,000. But there is quite a lot of money out there locally, state, so far, for minority AIDS program, you know, programs and so forth. And so I've taken advantage of that. I've had this.
I know with the Minority AIDS program now, I've seen in the Lexington paper that you actually have a program in Lexington as well as Louisville.
But we have programs in Bowling Green, Hopkinsville, and Lexington. Which, well, we received $1 million grant to fund these programs
from
CDC,
okay.
Center for Disease Control, and there are so many programs out there like that. Nearly every program that I have, we identify when you give to the foundation, you're not giving just for general support, you're supporting a particular program. For instance, National City Bank, the University of Louisville, Lowe's, LG&E, they will support a program we call Project Build, a program introducing high school students going into their senior year to the world of business. So I partnered with the University of Louisville, and we used the University of Louisville Business School for their classes. And so this is a partnership which I developed with the university. Another one has to do with the math and science program. We had 400 plus kids in math and science at the University of Louisville. The University of Louisville has assisted me by giving me a large sum of money, as well as the Jefferson County School System, to do this. And the University of Louisville do not charge us rent for these students. And this is a program we call Jumpstart. It's a program where a student, whatever course they're going to take in the fall, they take 4 weeks, 2 hours per class in math and science, and so that when they enter the class in the fall, they will have a jump start. And these are classes in physics, calculus, chemistry, biology, algebra 1, algebra 2, a very popular program that we have had there since 1978. Now, the other nuance that I like to tell, and the BUILD program came out of a program called Project LEAD. Out of Project
LEAD.
LEAD.
Okay.
It's an acronym.
To Project BUILD.
Well, what I was doing is I was recruiting students to go to institutions out of Louisville. For instance, students went to the University of Pennsylvania, Northwestern, and it was a program for minority students. And I said, now why do they are doing that there? Why don't I replicate it here? So I am an excellent replicator. And the same thing happened with the Whitney Young Scholars. That came out of Dr. Lang's program, I Have a Dream, in New York. I said, well, why can't we replicate what they're doing? Because Mr. Lang indicated to those students that if they could stay in school, that all of them would have scholarships to go to college. And that's basically what we're doing. And what I have been able to do is get all of these institutions to buy into that. So because these young people are academically talented, and they are economically challenged, what you do is, to be very honest with you, they are fighting over our kids. One, we have each year, we have at least $1 million worth of scholarship assistance that's available, and we only use 500,000 of that.
And why is that?
Because of choices made by young people. One of them is that we have always had this opening with a barrier for 10 scholarships. Mm-hmm. And we always have difficulty in getting students to choose barrier. Because these are urban kids, and when they go over there, they say, oh God, we do not want to go to a school in the country. Mm-hmm. And that plus, some of them don't like the work ethics of attending Berea. And so they want to go, not that they're lazy, but they just perceive working as being, hard labor, and they don't want to be having a part of it. So there are nearly all of the institutions in nearly all of the public institutions here in the state will say if your kid meets the criteria, they have a four-year package. Now, what we do is we work with the institution to be sure that they are eligible for Pell Grant, SEOG Grant, Work Study, and all of that. And then we supplement that with funds that we have received from an endowment of $1 million that we raised. I had 6 months to raise $500,000 for a challenge grant from the Brown Foundation. I raised $725,000. And so there at the foundation is $1 million endowment just for Whitney Young Scholars, which is for scholarship assistance. Now, part of that is that all of the graduates of the program receive no matter where they're going to, they'll receive a $500 scholarship from the foundation. Then the additional assistance is determined by need. They write and say that they need this amount, they will need this to supplement, and then so forth. But we also continue to to assist these young people when they're in college by every time they receive funds at the in December. We always ask them to show to give us the college grades and show them that they plan to, enrolled for the second semester. And then we give funds in August when they get ready to go. And so, and that's determined by how much we have received from the income from the endowment. We do not touch the principal. We just use the income. But we also have a program, a self-help program called Dollars for Scholars. And that's a program that we involve in parents and students who have various fundraising efforts. For instance, they have in February, they have a fashion show. And they contact the stores and the students fashion everything, and then whatever they raise is put in this pot. But only those who have been involved in Dollars for Scholars will get, at the end of their graduation, will they get some funds. But those who do not participate will not get any of that. Mm-hmm. And so but we have pretty good support from that, but it's also an excellent way to get parents involved in the process.
Children, do you think have been helped in some way by the foundation in your 26-year tenure?
I would say at least 5,000.
Wow.
At least 5,000. Mm-hmm. Because although students are not officially enrolled in program, I have anyone. Mm-hmm. If a student, and that's what I get. A lot of it is just informal. A student will come in. For instance, there's a young man that came to me this summer. And although we did not, we made some special rules. We do not usually take students after 10th grade. But this one student, and I've broken the rules several times. This student just hadn't heard of the program. And he had a 28 and a 3.8 GPA. Nobody talked to him about what college he wants to. 28 ACT and a 3.8. And he came to the Summer Science and Math program. And he enrolled, he had already had calculus, but he wanted to get close to the program and he took it again just to serve as a resource, a mentor.
Stop right there. Okay.
He said, this young man said they mentor with the others who were taking calculus, because you know calculus, many students perceive as being very difficult. So this young man is now a Whitney Young Scholar, and I have already secured, there are two places that he has a full 4-year scholarship to Florida A&M University, and he also has a full 4-year scholarship to Center. So he can take any, he's economically disadvantaged, single parent, works at McDonald's to assist himself. The epitome of sophistication.
He's how old?
17. Wow. Now one student I would love for you to meet, if you go to, he's at UK Law School. Mm-hmm. He is a Whitney M. Young Scholar. He graduated 4 points from points from Central High School, and he's had I think he had a 28 on ACT. He received nearly an entire financial package to Yale, and he's now in law school, and we have given him already $2,000 of support
from the Whitney and Young Scholars, and we will support him. Now this kid that lived with his sister did not have the, he was in and out with his parents. With his parents, I mean, he's phenomenal. In terms, I haven't ever seen anyone who has the sophistication of a middle class kid. And he's, well, I'm gonna tell you too much, and I won't do that. Okay, he has a brother, the same young man. He goes to Purdue. He's in engineering, has 3.0, GPA 3.2 or 4 at Purdue, and graduated. And it's really, and they're extremely handsome guys. And they carry themselves in a very middle-class manner. And I wonder, I often say, gosh, it makes me wonder. It just makes me wonder about a lot of things. You know, how much do genes, are genes working which determine how you present yourself? I really think about that. Because in my own family, we were very poor, but we acted middle class. I went to the opera and so forth. When I was in eighth grade, I had been to La Traviata, I'd seen Carmen, so forth. And I just kind of acted very middle class to come out of this extremely impoverished environment. I played tennis. I loved to play checkers. I learned to swim. I think it had something to do with my upbringing, because my mother would never have allowed me to wear these clothes, these that should hang down and so forth.
Well, you took advantage of the opportunities that were there to you, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, I think the influence was more that my mom and dad, my mom worked for this domestic family, and she often said, to be very honest, I received a lot of clothing. And that's what I received, because my classmates would have, I don't know, have you ever heard of drapes? I mean, why you down here in a zoop and all that? Oh, well, my classmates would wear that. In fact, I was labeled a little white boy, because I dressed, you know, I bought my clothes off the rack. And these kids, although they were economically disadvantaged, many of them worked, had jobs at the hotel, and they had a lot of money, and they dressed well. But then they would kind of laugh at me, you know, that here you come with these stow-about, some room-itself clothes that, you know, they never decided. What would happen in our neighborhood is that on various corners, there would be these rummage sales. Yes, okay.
You talked about that.
Okay.
I remember that. That's a great story. Of all the programs that you've been involved with at the Lincoln Foundation, do you have a favorite?
Oh, yes, I do. It's the Whitney and Young Scholars Program. Mm-hmm. It is. And that's the one that I'm having more trouble in getting, because I've already, I always wanted to be close to the youngsters, my role in it since the beginning of the program is to work with the seniors and their parents. Mm-hmm. I talk directly to the college admissions people. Mm-hmm. I arrange that, and the Saturday session, I arrange all of those. That was my, and so I was one, each youngster in the program would have to see interact with me twice for a one-on-one, where I determine, you know, what's your GPA, what's that? You're talking about going to Harvard with a 2.0. No. Let's get realistic in terms of what you, here you are making a 10 on the ACT and you want to go to center? No. We're going to do the realistic. And sometimes there are schools that take marginal students. That is their market. Are you aware of that?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. They take marginal students. I said, now, come on, what you do is go there and let's see how you do after 1 year. If you do very well, then I will assist you in getting into this other one that you want to do, want to get into. And that's how I've done. I extremely monitor their grades to see how they see must, and that's how I felt I wanted to be close to the youngsters, because otherwise I could be preoccupied with fundraising and administration and program development. But I feel like an administrator needs something to be hands-on with young people, and it keeps you humble.
You mentioned some students that were special to you. How about staff? Do you have any favorite staff people who worked with you over the years?
Yes. One was a white person who came to me and assisted me in the beginning of the program. Extremely dedicated to me in terms of sharing my vision. In the early years, he coordinated science and math programs for me. He was taught in the Catholic schools. He eventually left and went to New York to teach because his wife was from Colombia. Mm-hmm. Colombia is the country. Mm-hmm. And she had just received an MBA from Bellarmine. And she thought the opportunities were limited, and so he left here to, and he teaches in New York City.
And his name?
Patrick Compton.
Compton, okay.
Patrick Compton.
Okay.
Now, he was extremely dedicated that he joined in my African American fraternity. And that was really...
Tell me about that. That's pretty unusual.
Well, what was going on is that Patrick and I had an excellent working relationship. But some of my friends and some of my colleagues were suspicious of his motives. Mm-hmm. And they often would share that to me, that the relationship should be more of a distant relationship, because the feeling was that he was positioning himself to succeed me as the president of the Foundation. And so that's not unusual. The most recent vice president joined the fraternity that I belong to.
Was he white also?
Black, he was African American.
But at the time, was your fraternity obviously was predominantly African American, but open to whites? Or?
It, well, yeah, yes, yes. Well, it's...
Tell me the name of your
fraternity. The Phi Beta Sigma fraternity. It was founded in 1914 at Howard University.
Right.
And some of our outstanding members were George Washington Carver, Elaine Locke, Hewlin Jack, who was Burrough.
Well, how did the members of the fraternity feel about Patrick joining you?
Well, things were open, and Patrick could have easily, this has been recent, but he could have recently said that it was discrimination which kept him out.
This would have been how recent? What period are we talking about?
Let me see. It was 80-ish.
Okay. Sam, I got to stop if you're going to
It was 80-ish.
Okay.
Yeah, and especially when we had the Lincoln Institute reunion 1 year, I mean, they came down hard on me. Because he was there for every activity, right there with me, he was my right-hand person. And Minister Dr. Robinson, you better watch what's going on. And so I was, well, to be very honest with you, I think if he had continued in that role, he would be the person to succeed me. And because it was based on the work ethics, you know, that he showed and the compassion he had for all students.
How long was he with you?
Maybe 8 to 10 years. Okay. I mean, okay. So during the summers he would work and so forth, and anytime I needed him to do something, we didn't have to get into, you know, to negotiate it. It was that here I am, and I want to support you. And he took a lot of pressure off of me by addressing issues. And he was very much involved in, he was a friend of Father Robinson. If you ever read, you know, Father Robinson was, you know, definitely one out there before his time. Pat was a member of the NAACP.
I don't know Father Robinson.
Okay, well, that's another story in itself. How that's the story of the Urban Montessori. This is a man, at his death, he was buried, and he was extremely, well, that's a whole new story.
He's a Catholic priest, though.
He was at one time an Episcopalian priest, mm-hmm. and later went back, and he came from a very affluent family. But he has passed to the African-American Catholic congregation. Uh-huh. He lived in the West End at one time.
Okay.
He, all of this is, well, eventually, well, what's that? All of this property we own is now in a trust. But at the demise of the person, the sister, all of this will become, you know, owned by the Urban Montessori. But we have three locations and so forth. But Father Robinson was a very, very liberal person. And when he died, so what, like 4 or 5 years ago, he was, his body, he had an African American funeral home to be in charge. And his statement was he wanted to bring white folk to the West End. He said, if they wanted to see him, they had come to the West End. Really, a dear friend of mine. And that's why I get such a kick out of this job, is that I know the Father Robinson is smiling. I said, and I was nearly compelled to do this by our friendship, and because he had been very, very generous in terms of donation. And again, that came from, and that's basically has been my way of raising, developing relationships with people. Going where, serving on the board of the Kentucky Center for the Arts, the Louisville Orchestra, so forth. And to me, I feel that people give to individuals rather than cults and instances. You know.
So you basically developed your development scheme by being a good network.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Yes. And knowing exactly what I was after. I mean, because many times people are very busy and going to the orchestra at intermission, I could catch you and pigeonhole you and talk to you. Otherwise, some person on administrative assistant would give you flack in terms of trying to see them. And so that's part of it. You know, sometimes I've had to pay personally to go to an affair that cost maybe $400 or $500. I would use my own money. But I knew that would be an excellent place for me to meet some people and so forth. I'll be seated at the table with someone. And I've been fortunate to have a wife that has been very supportive of that. In fact, last night the mayor made a reference to His wife and I love to go to yard sales and consignment stores. And he brought out that that I was very much involved in that. And so my brothers and sisters all teased me about that because they say, gosh, you make a very good salary. Why don't you continue to go to, but that's just something I like to do.
Right.
And so,
and you shared the history with me when we talked earlier.
Yeah, about the rummage.
And also some incredibly good buys that found that way.
Oh, so, gosh, you just, I used to visit my home.
Yeah.
The type of artwork and pieces of antiques and so forth that I've gotten, that some people's junk is others' treasures.
That's right. Sam, talk to me a little bit about the board, the history of the board at the Lincoln Foundation. You said that prior to your being there, they only met twice a year.
Yes.
Now
the board meets quarterly.
Okay.
But
who are the board members?
Well, to be very honest with you, most of the board members, present board members, have been recruited by me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been recruited by me, and usually if someone comes along, they ask me how I feel they will work out. Mm-hmm. Many of the board members have come by persons I have seen leadership skills and so forth that have that I have asked to come on our board. You know, for instance, a good example, Ted Roske is presently chairman of the board. Ted and I served on the Louisville Orchestra board together. I said, Ted, you would make an excellent person to serve on our board. And so I give the names to the nominating committee, and then that's how it has been done over there. Another good example is Alan Houston, the mother of Alan Houston, who plays for the New York Knickerbocker. Now, I've known Alice a long time, and Alice worked with the Urban League, and she worked in recruitment at U of L while her husband served as an assistant coach to Denny Crown. And you know, and you know, he did become the coach of the University of Tennessee at one time. Now, Alice is over it, and Alice is has done quite well with their trucking firms and so forth. And Alice, you know, I said, Alice, you need to be on board. And she said, okay. And that's basically how. Then lately what we are trying to do is interest young people whose parents were very good board members to come on board of the foundation. Mm-hmm. Now that's tricky business because many of the time the young people do not share the same compassion. They have other causes and so forth, and then you have to nurture them and develop them and so that they will come on the board.
What about young people who actually have benefited from the programs as they matured? Have you ever put any of them on the board?
Yes, we have. We've had several. For instance, one of the doctors who received assistance through medical school from us, he's an anesthesiologist, and now he has changed his practice to pain, this whole new area of pain that he has served as a person on the board. We have had several of young people. For instance, right now, that was one of the goals we were going to do this year was to begin to involve the young people in an advisory group, help us with fundraising in terms of Lincoln Institute Alumni Associates or something like that, because many of them but want to help, but they don't know how to help. You know, and so that's what we have attempted to do.
Okay. One more question. Now that you've retired from the Lincoln Foundation and you've come on with Urban Montessori, and I take it you're going to do some big development work here.
Yes, I
too.
Am.
What else for you?
Well, I have. There's one position that will be announced later that I haven't even told you about because we're in the negotiation stage.
Okay.
There's with the school two areas that which need attention. The areas are enrollment in some of the schools and development. We need to increase the number, and we have a dinner coming up the 25th, and it's sold out. So what we had to do in terms of tables, we had to start going to badge because we could not sell. And so next year we have to look for a larger venue. And I have already a vision, but I have to be very careful that I do not try to steal some of the Lincoln Foundation supporters for support. But I think there's a lot out there for everyone, and I'm in the process of generating new supporters, some of those that have not been tapped before, because we're very reluctant to even do that, because I think it would not be the right thing to do. So I have been steering very clear of developing, so I see this as a board, and so some of these accolades will enhance my efforts.
I believe I read, Sam, in one of the articles that you and your wife were celebrating your retirement and you were going to buy an orange Mercedes.
Yeah.
Did you do that?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did. I just felt like that. Well, it was just something that I just wanted to do, and I did it, and I'm.
And you're enjoying it?
Well, not really. I haven't gotten to the place where, you know, because I have to figure out the appropriateness of driving it, so forth. You know, because it would be ostentatious to some people. Turn off some people, and I haven't worked out that. Mm-hmm. I just kind of keep it, right now it's in a parking place, and I haven't driven it this week, but I know I got to go down there and start the park, because I just have time. As old folk would say, I see that as a going to church car, mm-hmm. and taking it home and getting it out, and the owner tells me that I need to drive it to keep it in good shape.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, I really would like to add something about my children and my child rearing. My wife and I have different demeanors. My wife is a very kind, compassionate person. And she has always, as in child rearing, she had difficulty in punishing. And I did not have any problem with punishing. And my daughters, you know, punishing girls can be, you know, difficult at times. But I read them as if they were males in terms of expectations. They always had jobs during the summer. I asked they could go to come here and work with me, and no, Dad doesn't know when to come home. So we'll be working from 8 to 8 or whatever. They always had chores. I attempted to screen them from by taking an interest in their boyfriends and what they were telling them. We lived in a when school desegregation came, they have always been pretty middle class, and pretty much the only African-American, my daughter was the only African-American cheerleader at Ballard High School. And then, this was in the 70s. But she developed that determination, I think, from what I tried to do with her. She's now the Director of Staff Development for the Beverly Enterprises, a nurse and senior citizen home in Atlanta, several. And she says that both of us have played a role in terms of her having this aggressive nature. She's aggressive, very, very aggressive. But I also say that she has developed excellent human relation skills because of her upbringing. She has always been in an atmosphere where she was the one or two African Americans, and she has been able to hold her own. The other thing had to do with...
Now, she's the oldest?
She's the oldest. And she... Now the younger daughter is not as aggressive. For instance, within a family, you will say, everybody calls her my daughter. And my other younger daughter is my wife's daughter.
And tell me their names, the oldest.
My oldest one is Deborah.
Okay.
Deborah, and she's married to a young man who is who's right now preparing to become a lieutenant in the Atlanta Police Department. And
I have to stop you and turn the tape.
Preparing to become a lieutenant in the Atlanta Police, and he works in homicide. Now, and he also is a part-time funeral director. His father owns a funeral home in Atlanta. So and then the other daughter, Charlotte, is married to a fine young man who is who works in computers. She works as a respiratory therapist at DeKalb Medical Center
in
Atlanta. She lives in Stone Mountain, and the other daughter lives in Gwinnett. And they both own their homes. They're buying their homes. And my one daughter, the older daughter, has two boys. They are 12 and 6. And the other daughter has two daughters, 3 and 5. And my daughter informed, the younger daughter informed me that at the Christmas holidays that she will be having twins.
Oh, my goodness.
In July.
She's going to have her hands full.
Yes, yes. So we have always been extremely supportive, and we're very blessed that we have two fine son-in-laws. Mm-hmm. They belong to church, they go to Bible study, so forth. One issue that I have more than has to do with the availability of items for my grandchildren. I think in many instances that they overdo it. I think you can overdo it. Mm-hmm. And I think that I would like to see them become a little old, more aggressive and disciplined. Mm-hmm. So when the young people, each group of young people spend two to three weeks with us in the summer. So I get a chance to work on some of that. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to, because they are extremely bright children. And it's just that they're just going to have to be nurtured. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.